Chapter 7. Closing the First Circle. Sandrine. When Paloma de Denachon asked him if he still had the mobile phone he was using in the spring of 2016, 4 years earlier, Jorge Carrasco was a bit befuddled. It was October 2020, and Paloma was in Mexico for the final stages of the cartel project, now racing to the finish line. She and a small camera crew were spending most of a Saturday doing a follow-up interview with Jorge to tie up some loose ends about the murder of his Proceso colleague, Regina Martinez, and the aftermath. But Paloma's other assignment that day was to persuade Jorge to agree to have his phone analyzed for possible spyware infection. Laurent and I had spent a lot of time strategizing with Paloma about how exactly to make the ask of Jorge. We wanted to tell him as much as we could without divulging the fact that we had access to this enormous amount of leaked data about NSO and Pegasus. Paloma only brought it up to Jorge at the end of the day, with the interview in the can. She was as direct as she could be, explaining that Forbidden Stories was interested in reviewing the contents of his old phone with a new forensic tool that two experts at Amnesty International's security lab had developed. Jorge assumed it was part of the reporting on the cartel project, but the lack of definite information from Paloma only fed his growing sense of frustration and his growing sense that he was being left in the dark about important aspects of an investigation in which he was a key partner. A few months earlier, as soon as we had first learned his phone might have been infected with Pegasus, we had asked Jorge to absent himself from the signal group dedicated to the cartel project. Since then, we had been communicating with him exclusively through one of the reporters who worked for him at Proceso. "I remember talking to Sandrine to ask for more exchange," Jorge later explained. I had been struck by the fact that communication between us had been reduced. Jorge Carrasco is a very capable journalist and a very insightful man. He had spent 20 years reporting on issues that raised hackles across private enterprises and public institutions in Mexico. The doings of drug traffickers, as well as the doings of various police, military, and intelligence agencies. He had done significant work on the hacking team leak in 2015 and the use of the RCS spyware in his country. He and his fellow reporters and editors at Proceso had also done follow-up stories in 2017 after Citizen Lab found evidence that Pegasus had been used to target Carmen Aristegui and other Mexican journalists, and on proponents of a soda tax enacted by the Mexican government, and even on lawyers representing some of the parents of the 43 students who had gone missing in Guerrero. Jorge had wondered for years if he, too, was a target of cyber surveillance. He did still have his old phone, but alas, he told Paloma when she asked him that Saturday, in October 2020, he couldn't remember the PIN number. Mexico was presenting a series of difficulties for Paloma just then. The country was a hard place for a 23-year-old reporter to learn her trade. She had managed to retain her disarming habit of smiling at the end of every statement she made and every question she asked, which proved very effective in putting people at ease. But a charming mannerism wasn't always enough in Mexico. Paloma had spent days in Veracruz getting to know Regina Martinez's closest friends, but none were willing to go on the record to talk about her unsolved death. It didn't matter to them that the case was long past, more than 7 years old. The ghosts of Veracruz keep close and seem always present. After a few days in the city, Paloma's antennae were more sensitive than usual. She was phoning back to our office in Paris to update us every day she was in Mexico, and her calls from Veracruz could be worrisome. I remember her call the day she had visited the street where Regina Martinez had lived and died. Paloma had a bad feeling about that street, she told us, like there was an ill wind blowing through the site. She had also begun to sense that some of the people in the neighborhood were not to be trusted. One of her best sources was so upset, he made her get in a cab and go to another location. "Let's get the hell out of here," he told her, where they could talk safely. What amazed me at the time was how the things that had persuaded Laurent to hire Paloma a year earlier, her curiosity and her fearlessness, seemed unchecked. Her full surname, Dupont de Dinichamps, suggested she came from an aristocratic French family with a long history and big castles. Nothing else about her did. Paloma was raised by what she would describe as hippie parents. Her father was French and her mother Chilean. The first thing that struck us about Paloma, from the very first meeting with her, was her diligence. Before she came in for her job interview, she had read every single word published by Forbidden Stories. She could paraphrase and quote interviews Laurent had given years earlier, when he was trying to get Forbidden Stories off the ground. She was also possessed of a natural maturity and a toughness that must have come in handy on her chosen field of sport, rugby. Fluent in French, English, and Spanish, Paloma had, before she was 22, completed a documentary short about violence against the indigenous citizens of Chile, and done a 6-month reporting internship at a digital publication in Guerrero, one of the most dangerous areas in Mexico. Once hired, she very quickly became a key point of contact for our best sources on the cartel project, the person our partners at other media outlets would turn to when they needed somebody to check a fact or go back to a difficult source. At the end of the project, she was fielding 10 separate calls a day, requesting her to provide some confirmation or another. So I had no qualms about sending Paloma to convince Jorge to be the test case on the forensics. The first number in the data we would actually check. Jorge showed up at Paloma's hotel a few days after the interview carrying his old phone. It took some time and many different attempts, but he finally did get a PIN number that unlocked the device. He had some hesitation about allowing us to make a backup of the contents of his phone, which would include Jorge's contact list, all the text messages he had sent, and, crucial to our project, all the text messages he had received, with timestamps. He wanted to know if the security lab would delete all the data when they were finished, and how long they would need to keep the backup. When Paloma explained we would need about 2 weeks to complete the analysis, he said that seemed like a long time. But he did finally agree to let her make the backup and upload the file to Claudio and Danica in Berlin. The process sounds simple, but this was new to Paloma. She only had time for a quick, simulated run-through in Paris before she had decamped for Mexico. It required several attempts over several excruciating hours to get the backup files off Jorge's phone and successfully uploaded to the security lab's forensic platform. Then Claudio and Danica put their new tool to work, looking for a very specific piece of evidence. At the time, Danica says, "We were having all these discussions about, what does the data mean?" That was the big question. We were a little bit concerned that we wouldn't be able to find the spyware, and maybe it wasn't going to be successful. The first aha moment came when the security lab tool isolated that one strange text message from an unknown sender. "Hello, Jorge. I am sharing this memo that Animal Politico published today. I think it's important to reshare." Jorge had received that message with the link just a few hours after his phone number, according to the data in the leaked list, had been selected. Not only did the timestamp of the selection match up with the suspicious text message, but the phone number of the sender was also significant, because it was the same number, already identified in a published report from Citizen Lab, that sent Carmen Aristegui several SMS messages, that linked to a fake website that would then load an exploit designed to install Pegasus spyware. There was no evidence of actual infection, because Jorge had wisely not clicked on the link that would have launched the attack. But Jorge's iPhone had clearly been targeted, according to the evidence found by the forensic tool, and it was clearly linkable to NSO. Better than that, Jorge was a new find. He had not been among the dozen or so journalists and private citizens in Mexico who had already been identified as targets of Pegasus. The first number we had been able to check in the leaked data was not only confirmed as a target of an NSO client, but a previously unknown target. Even to a technological amateur like me, it seemed very unlikely that Jorge would be the one and only new victim the security lab forensic tool would turn up among the 50,000 numbers in the dataset. Claudio and Denica didn't show it when they presented their first report to us, but they later told us they had been buoyed by the findings. The evidence of a Pegasus targeting sitting in Jorge's phone, evidence they now had, was a validation of the data itself. You see the number in the data, and then you see the message appearing in the data at the right time, just when we expect the message to appear. So it was really a confirmation that we were on the right track. There was still a long way to go. Still a chance they could, as Danica said, whiff. But as Claudio put it, exhibiting his characteristic restraint, this, could work. Shortly after Paloma returned to Paris from Mexico, pressure began building at the Forbidden Stories office. In the first days of December 2020, I would occasionally notice Laurent standing by an open window in the office, smoking a cigarette, an old habit he always fell back into in the tense days just before and just after the publication of a major investigation. The cartel project was scheduled to go live across the world in a few days, at 6 p.m. Paris time, December 6, 2020, and our own small team was working long, hard hours. They were writing their own stories, while also fielding calls from our partners all over the world. The partners wanted Paloma to check a fact about Veracruz, or for Audrey to point out specifics from shipping manifests from China or India she had discovered, or for Phineas to reconfirm the number of Berettas and Glocks and other handguns sold into Mexico from Europe or Israel or the United States. Editors and lawyers from various partners called in to parse the language of specific allegations and suggest last-minute emendations. This was my first experience coordinating an international investigation, and it felt a bit like herding cats. There were 60 journalists total in the consortium, from 25 discrete media outlets in 18 different countries, contributing to the cartel project, and they too were working overtime in the final days before publication. Many were adding reporting to the still mysterious circumstances of the murder of Regina Martinez. Others had picked up the threads of stories Regina had left unfinished at the time of her death. Those threads, as well as the threads left behind from dozens of the 119 Mexican journalists killed in the previous 20 years, started in Veracruz and Guerrero and Sinaloa, but spooled out all over the world. The cartels were getting precursor chemicals for mixing fentanyl from Asia, and laundering money through Spain, and buying guns from Austria and Italy and America, which meant each of the partners had a particular local angle to the story about which they felt proprietary. I was sympathetic when a journalist from one European outlet called me to say they might not be able to hold a story about methamphetamine labs in their country, servicing the Mexican drug traffickers. He worried a rival news outlet in their home country might beat them to the punch. This was not an easy position to be in. Nobody wants to be second on a story they've worked on this hard. But I also knew I had to be firm with our nervous partner. No other single outlet anywhere was going to bring the depth and sweep to this story that our international consortium could. More important, there was a deal in place, agreed to by all the partners, that the first stories would not drop until the appointed hour, and then would roll out in a predetermined order over the ensuing days. If one of the partners started early, I feared it could lead to a stampede among the other partners. This would not only blunt the force of the revelations, but it would also threaten what the Forbidden Stories collaborative model depended on most: trust among the partners. I didn't get much sleep in the days leading up to publication. When I wasn't fielding calls or making final edits, I found myself obsessively refreshing web pages to see if any of our partners had jumped the gun. I did have to call somebody in the Americas to ask them to take down a screenshot of the Cartel Project documentary they had uploaded. But then, mercifully, the project went live right at the appointed hour, perfectly synchronized on media sites around the world. The first day stories focused on the life and death of the Proceso reporter we had chosen to put at the center of the project. The headlines were splashed on front pages of newspapers and bannered as lead stories on websites across the globe. Murder of Regina Martinez, one of many. Unanswered questions haunt case of Mexican journalist's murder. Slain journalist's story, a portrait of a violent, corrupt era in Mexico. This journalist's brutal murder was dismissed as a robbery. Now reporters from around the world are determined to uncover the truth. The pickup from other outlets was immediate and kept growing. The first hours after initial publication felt like a jolt of electricity through our otherwise exhausted office. The idea of a big group of journalists from all over the world cooperating on a single story had been a matter of theory for me up to that point, almost academic. Collaboration is not the natural impulse among those who practice the trade of journalism. Most of the challenge, and half of the fun of reporting, is getting the story nobody else has. But that day, when the Cartel Project was rolling out, it finally felt real. And I was struck by the sheer power of a collaborative enterprise. The teamwork had amplified both the reporting and its impact. We had something to celebrate, and somebody from Forbidden Stories, probably Cecile, had already carried in the requisite champagne and wine and beer. It wasn't long before we were popping the corks, and I saw Laurent and Paloma standing near an open window, both having a smoke. In the middle of all the revelry, we invited all our partners to join a celebratory Zoom call. Laurent's old friend and founding board member, Bastian Obermeier, offered a toast to all the partners. Others chimed in. Dana Priest, a deft Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist from the Washington Post, put a bow on the day for all of us. Dana said she was particularly impressed at how this group had managed to put Regina Martinez's face and her story on front pages across the world. Headlines and front-page news about a journalist were a rare thing. The Cartel Project team had not only told the story of Regina's courage in reporting on drugs and corruption in Veracruz, and followed her old leads to new stories, but the international outcry had also shamed the current president of Mexico to call for reopening the investigation into her death. "I feel like we made her live again," I remember Dana saying. Cartel Project stories were still rolling out 3 days later, when Laurent and I made a previously arranged call to Dana, who was at her farm outside Washington, D.C. "Have you gotten any sleep yet?" was the first thing she wanted to know. "I was tired," she said. "You must have been exhausted." Laurent didn't spend much time on small talk or on another round of kudos on our recent mutual success. We were turning the page to a new project, and we wanted to get Dana and the Washington Post to sign on as one of the key partners. "Basically, to explain briefly," he told Dana, "we have access to a lot of information about a massive surveillance campaign all over the world, in many countries, targeting many, many people. A lot of people, and including a lot of very big names, heads of state, Nobel Prize winners, many journalists. If you are interested, we really need to be able to meet physically to tell you more. We say that because it's involving many intelligence units, and all of them would be very upset if they knew that one of us has access to that information. If we get hacked, it's over. Dana was technically on a sabbatical at the time, but she generously agreed to talk to the head of investigations at the Post, and then to set up an in-person meeting so we could make our pitch as soon as we could get to the States. It was almost 6 weeks later, the day before the U.S. presidential inauguration in January 2021, when Laurent and I finally arrived in Washington, D.C., to make our case to Dana and the editor from the Post. We had by then grown even more anxious to lock in the renowned Washington newspaper. Die Zeit and Süddeutsche Zeitung and Le Monde had agreed to operate as reporting partners with Forbidden Stories on the cyber surveillance project. The Post would be the fourth and final member of the first circle of the investigation, the crucial U.S. partner. As we peered out the car window on the ride into town from the airport, it was hard to feel hopeful. The U.S. capital city was a bleak and embattled landscape at that point, reeling from the four-year reign of Donald Trump, and braced for its last ugly spasms. The daily COVID-19 death toll in the country had passed 3,000 and was still rising. The reflecting pool had been ringed with 400 lanterns, each representing 1,000 U.S. citizens already lost. The medical trauma was like the handmaiden of the political. The Trump-led effort to overturn the election had been punctuated, less than 2 weeks before our arrival, by a deadly riot at the seat of national government. News feeds were still filled with newfound footage of Confederate flag-wielding marauders storming the U.S. Capitol, ransacking the Speaker's office and both chambers of the legislature, chasing representatives and senators and their aides into safe rooms in the bowels of the building, beating police officers bloody, and looting camera equipment from journalists on scene to cover the story. Enemies of the people, the American president had called reporters, making them, and us, just another in a long list of groups with targets on their backs. The normally festive run-up to the presidential inauguration had all the charm of a prison yard lockdown. The Capitol grounds were fenced by 7-foot-high chain link, said to be unscalable. Armored military vehicles sat at key entrances. The perimeter and streets nearby were patrolled by 6,000 uniformed soldiers shouldering assault rifles. Laurent and I quickly aborted our one attempt to get some exercise with a run on the mall. Then we ended up staying in our hotel to watch the inauguration on television, while the ceaseless shudder of helicopters rattled our windows. We were cheered only slightly by the performance of 22-year-old poet Amanda Gorman. I couldn't take my eyes off her effulgent yellow overcoat, and the way her hands and fingers cut powerfully through the air, measuring her cadences as she spoke. "For there is always light, if only we're brave enough to see it. If only we're brave enough to be it." The rest of the pallid, pared-down ceremony felt like a sad reminder of what the world becomes when autocrats begin to use their chosen weapons to chip away at even the strongest of democracies. When we met Dana at her home the day after the inauguration, she seemed a little perturbed by our request that she turn off her cell phone and laptop and put them in another room before we got started. In fact, I wasn't sure she was sold on this new cyber surveillance project. But we were now able to access the data by remote hookup, so it was easy to show her the scope and scale of the data in the leaked list. The reservations she had about the potential of this story seemed to melt away as she scrolled down that massive list, and we highlighted some of the names we had already identified as targets selected for cyber surveillance. 2 days later, Dana was driving us across the city for our sit-down with the head of the Washington Post's investigative units, Jeff Lean. Jeff was working remotely from his home about 30 miles from downtown Washington at the time, but he agreed to meet us at the National Arboretum, a midway point. Laurent and I were both a bit nervous, because even though Jeff had been the editor in charge of the cartel project at the Post, we hadn't actually been in the same room with him yet. Dana didn't exactly calm our nerves as she piloted us to the arranged meeting spot. She put us through our paces, rehearsing our pitch. "This guy doesn't have much time," she explained, "and he gets pitched the next big scoop every day, so don't waste time." There was a lot about the leak we wouldn't be able to explain until the Post agreed to become a partner in the project. We were nervous about telling Jeff that the company at the center of the investigation was NSO, but we knew we couldn't hold back that alluring piece of information. NSO was not only the most recognized software developer in the world, but there were suspicions that the company's cyber tool was somehow linked to the recent murder of a journalist who had contributed to the Post's opinion pages. We agreed with Dana that the main selling point, and the big takeaway of the project if we pulled it off, would be the revelation of the vast scale of cyber surveillance now taking place around the world, thanks in large part to Pegasus. A strict follower of the COVID-careful 6-foot rule, Jeff wasn't interested in taking the meeting in the warmth of Dana's SUV. So the four of us got out of our cars and marched across the parking lot, down a sloping grade, and through the entrance of the Arboretum. Nobody else was in the park, as far as I could see. The sky was a crystalline blue, but it was very cold, and the wind was whipping, so I was glad I had worn a parka and a warm hat and an extra pair of socks. Jeff was a tall guy, swaddled in a thick coat and a bulky pair of insulated trousers. He was wearing what looked like some kind of trapper hat, with the flaps hanging down, and a pair of the biggest gloves I have ever seen. The head of one of the most technologically advanced investigative teams in the United States was using a clipboard you might see in a middle school gym class circa 1980 to take notes. It felt like we were in a scene from a very odd spy movie, where one of the protagonists happens to be the foreman of a lumberjack crew from Saskatchewan. Laurent and I led with the sheer scale of international cyber surveillance suggested by the list. But we were upfront about what we knew and what we didn't know about the leaked data we were ready to offer the Post. There were some remarkable names on the list, but we had a lot of work to do to determine if the people were simply selected for spyware infection, or actually targeted, or successfully infected. "Okay," he said. "Understood." Dana was right. He didn't waste time. He only asked a couple of questions, like if there were any Americans in the data. The whole talk lasted less than 20 minutes. It occurred to me that on any other project, we could have wrapped this up in a couple of transatlantic phone calls. But our promise to protect the source at all costs meant we had to make our way from Paris to this freezing spot in a taxpayer-funded forest in Washington, D.C., for what might end up being a failed story pitch. Jeff never said, "Wow," or "This is fantastic," or "I can't wait to get going." "What do you need from me?" was all he said. We suggested we would need a lot of resources in the coming months, but for now, maybe a staff reporter to work with Dana. "Okay," Jeff said. "Understood." We took that as a yes. So by the last week of January 2021, things were lining up. Claudio and Danica had done a successful test run on Jorge's phone. I had coordinated my first major international reporting collaboration. Our young team at Forbidden Stories had proven themselves solid, and Laurent and I had gathered a very experienced group of partners to execute the first phase of the Pegasus investigation. as Claudio might put it. This, could work.